and save the Iran nuclear deal. He told them that discussions have become less general and more focused, particularly regarding US sanctions against Iran and the Islamic Republic's nuclear energy program.
I talked with Secretary of State Blinken last week when he was in Brussels. I also talked with Minister Sharif. I think that both parts are really interested in reaching an agreement.
Borrell talks about an agreement, but critics say the EU has been much too soft on the US. After all, an agreement was reached in 2015. It was endorsed by the UN. Only the US broke the terms of the accord when Donald Trump took Washington out of the deal almost 3 years ago.
With Iran, we'll see what happens.
Analysts say in those 3 years, the EU, as coordinator of the deal, officially called the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action, failed to stand up to Trump. Representatives from Iran, Russia, China, France, Britain, Germany, and the European Commission are attempting to preserve the accord during negotiations in the Austrian capital. US officials are there on the sidelines of the talks. Given that the nuclear deal is underpinned by UN Resolution 2231, the vast majority of diplomats agree it should be respected.
We are 193 member states of the United Nations. Of course, the United States, as you've rightly pointed out, is a powerful member state, but they are a member state. And so we need to rally the numbers against those that may have different opinions.
Some citizens we've been talking to say Tel Aviv is behind efforts to derail the nuclear agreement.
Israel have interest and Israel are kind of pushing America.
Frankly, what we need is more peace and not more warmongering.
Tehran insists the only way the issue can be resolved is if Washington lifts all of its illegal sanctions. Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
He has imposed more tight restrictions to fight the spread of the coronavirus. Earlier, Turkish president said that the daily lockdown during the first 2 weeks of the holy month of Ramadan will start at 7 p.m. instead of 9 p.m. The lockdown will last till 5 a.m. every day, as the weekend lockdown will continue with stricter measures and more police officers present in the streets to make sure citizens and residents are abiding by the rules. During the weekend, security forces in all 81 provinces were out to make sure people are not violating the lockdown. Tourists are the only ones allowed to be outside during the lockdowns. In Istanbul alone, some 20,000 policemen took part in this campaign. Turkish Interior Minister threatened to punish those who do not respect the rules.
We will be out with our full force. Foreigners with residency permits are also subjected to restrictions and lockdowns, and they have to obey the rules just like others. I have the authority to revoke the residency permits of those who try to exploit the situation, pretending to be tourists. We will not let this happen.
The death toll in Turkey surged last month when restrictions were relaxed. Some blame the people who didn't act responsibly. Others blame the government for taking decisions based on the economic needs of the country rather than what is better for people's health. Analysts believe the government must take stricter measures. However, it is the economic situation that is preventing it from doing so.
The government is doing its best against the pandemic, but unfortunately the cases are rising because the country cannot afford full closure of businesses. Therefore, semi-closure is the only solution, and people must be more responsible.
Turkish Health Ministry said 20 million vaccine jabs have been distributed across the country. This is as Turkey says it has potentially developed a vaccine that just entered the phase of human trials. Turkish Industry and Technology Minister Mustafa Varank has volunteered for the trials. Turkish government wants to welcome tourists again after the holy month of Ramadan. However, many believe it is still too soon for this step, as only 25% of citizens have been vaccinated. Rashan Saglam, Istanbul.
After mass scenes of a failed security operation against thousands of protesters demanding the expulsion of French ambassador from Pakistan, the public resentment pitched high when the police launched operation against the protesters in the eastern city of Lahore. At the heart of public outrage is the revoking of a 6-month-old agreement by the government with Tehreek-e-Labbaik Pakistan, or the TLP, a political and religious group. The TLP championed the cause to expel French ambassador over repeated incident of blaspheming of Muslim Prophet Muhammad and their official patronage by the French government. The TLP supporters allegedly attacked a police station in Lahore and kidnapped 11 policemen, including a senior official. Later on, the protesters released all the police officials. The police says an oil tanker with over 50,000 liters of fuel was also taken away by the protesters, which caused ripples within the corridors of power of its possible explosion. A strong public reaction once again forced the government to halt its security operation. There were countrywide wheel jam strike and closure of businesses after many opposition parties and other religious groups announced to support the TLP's demand to expel French ambassador.
How long we would put up with incidents like burning of Holy Quran? How long we would put up with blasphemy being committed against our Prophet Muhammad, peace be upon him? But now we have decided not to tolerate it any longer.
Alarmed by public backlash, Prime Minister Imran Khan struggled hard in his live address to the nation to calm down public anger.
When Muslim countries stand up together and collectively boycott trade with France over blasphemy incidents, then it would have an impact. I would lead this campaign internationally now to prevent incidents of blasphemy.
Pakistan banned TLP last week, declaring it a terrorist organization in a country where violence against the police has become a norm by almost all major political parties to press their demands.
The government has resumed negotiation with the TLP, which is not ready to settle down on anything short of the expulsion of French ambassador from Pakistan. Now the TLP seems to be on a far more strong footing after a failed security operation against them. Therefore, analysts believe that the government is also running out of options but to withdraw its decision to ban it. Javed Rana, Islamabad.
The factory in the south of Tehran, where a new vaccine named Osvid would be produced within a few months to immune people against the deadly coronavirus. The name is taken from the pharmaceutical company that is developing the vaccine in collaboration with a knowledge-based firm. The joint project will soon be tested on humans to be mass-produced in the capital, Tehran.
Given that the initial phases of the Osvid 19 are completed and the earlier stages, including the animal phase, were carried out on rats and monkeys successfully, we need to launch this mass production line, and now we are prepared.
I asked the officials whether the formula is imported from other countries or it is indigenous, and this was the answer.
Not even a single word of the 420-page project of the vaccine has been non-native. It's fully developed in Iran. We took samples from the first patients at the beginning of the pandemic. Then it was characterized, inactivated, and cultivated. The job has been a very complicated teamwork and totally indigenous.
Right now, the company is producing the vials, and as the manager said, they can produce up to 6,000 every hour. They also told us that there is a capacity to produce about 20 million doses of the jab in a year. After the official ceremony in which the vial was unveiled, the vice president for science and technology launched the production line.
Within the past few years, very good things have been achieved in the domain of vaccine production in the country. This year, we have several corona vaccines to be mass-produced. This vial production line is a very important infrastructure for other companies that are developing the vaccine.
The Osvid vaccine must be injected in two stages with a three-week interval.
Iran says the second phase of vaccination against COVID-19 will begin in early May, and at this stage, about 15 million people would be vaccinated against the coronavirus. To this end, the country needs about 30 million doses of the vaccine, out of which a great number will be homemade ones. Fuman Abedi, Tehran.
America's longest war in Afghanistan is going to end as Washington has pledged to pull out its forces from the country in 5 months. Apart from other consequences of Washington's war in Afghanistan, casualties caused by the conflict over the past two decades showed that almost 90,000 Afghan and U.S. military forces, more than 70,000 civilians, and over 84,000 terrorists have lost their lives since 2001. The main cause behind such casualties is said to be Washington's failures, including taking the Taliban not so seriously. Although weak presence of Taliban was seen in remote villages of Afghanistan in 2001, it slowly expanded its maneuver area to big cities by launching bomb attacks or complex assaults in and after 2005. The attacks mostly claimed the lives of civilians. In response, Afghan and foreign troops launched more military operations, especially air strikes, increasing human losses in the country. Now that Washington has realized there is no military solution to the Afghan war, U.S. President Joe Biden announced on Wednesday that all U.S. troops will leave the war-torn country by September 11, the 20th anniversary of the 9/11 attacks. The Afghan government strongly believes that the Taliban will never be able to take control over the country militarily due to high capabilities of Afghan National Armed Troops in the fight against terrorism.
The Afghan Defense Ministry, in close cooperation with other government bodies, is fully ready to confront the worst-case scenario. Concerns of some international intelligence agencies are because of the security of their own countries. But we are not worried because we are now capable enough to defend our nation.
Meneher also argued that the only way to put an end to bloodshed in Afghanistan is the establishment of a united front by Afghan people without being dependent on foreign players, and convince the Taliban to lay down their arms.
The time has arrived for all Afghans to come together and set aside differences in order to use the ongoing peace process as an opportunity for the country to see peace and stability after decades-long war and violence.
While all players are waiting for the launch of Turkey summit on the Afghan peace process, the Taliban say they are not willing to attend it because the U.S. violated the terms of the agreement signed between the two in Doha, February last year. Based on the Doha agreement, U.S. military forces have to leave Afghanistan by May 1st. Sayed Amin Alami, Kabul.
A show of military might. Different units of the Islamic Republic of Iran's army paraded the forces' latest military equipment on the National Army Day. In Tehran, commanders of the Army's Air Force, Navy, and Ground Force, as well as senior commanders of the Islamic Revolution Guards Corps, were present to oversee the event. Ahead of the ceremonies, a message from leader of Iran's Islamic Revolution, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei, was read out, where he praised the contributions the Army has made to the security of the country. Army officials say serving the Iranian people is their top priority.
In fact, through these parades, we seek to send messages to our nation. We want to tell our people that we will continue to stand with you to ensure your peace and security, just as we have done over the past four decades.
The parades featured the latest military achievements and weaponry of the Iranian army, including radars, tanks, armored vehicles, and fighter jets. The highlight was the latest drones, missiles, and missile systems that are developed inside the country, including Sayyad and Mirsad missile systems. The Islamic Republic provides for 80% of its defensive needs domestically. Officials say the country owes this to four decades of arms embargoes imposed on the country by the U.S. and its allies.
What we did in the past four decades was to look at the sanctions as an opportunity to rely on our own resources. We discovered new potentials inside the country, and here we are today producing nearly every essential military equipment, from missiles to UAVs. So today, our security is not tied to foreign arms suppliers.
The National Army Day was designated in 1979, following a historic speech by late founder of the Islamic Republic, Imam Khomeini. Back then, he thanked the army for its role in the victory of the Islamic Revolution by announcing its neutrality, as the former Pahlavi regime pushed commanders to suppress the revolution. Every year, this massive parade sends strong messages of security to Iranians and the region. But on top of all the messages, the annual occasion is widely interpreted as the army's renewed support for the Islamic establishment. Where officials say, with or without sanctions, the Iranian armed forces continue to defend the country's sovereignty.
Yusuf Jamali, Tehran.
The seventh holy month of Ramadan since the start of the war on Yemen has arrived, and Yemeni struggle continues. The rising cost of living makes shopping for essentials a difficult task, as most Yemenis depend on daily wages.
We're going through a harsh economic condition. The ongoing blockade and war imposed by the Saudi-led coalition have put us in deep troubles. We hardly earn our livelihood and can't afford to buy food for Ramadan.
Tradesmen say they didn't earn much this year due to severe fuel crisis that led to the rising of prices of foodstuffs. Meanwhile, deteriorating economic condition has forced many companies to discharge thousands of their employees.
The purchasing power of people in Yemen has weakened significantly. The prices are rising because the Saudi-led coalition is still preventing entry of oil ships to Yemen. We are suffering greatly from the ongoing war and blockade.
Yemen is on the brink of famine and facing the world's worst humanitarian crisis, according to the United Nations, since Saudi-led coalition backed by Washington launched a devastating war on the war-ravaged nation at the beginning of 2015.
Despite the tragic humanitarian situation in their country, Yemenis welcome Ramadan with hopes of an end to war. They say their army's escalation of retaliatory attacks is pushing Riyadh further into a political solution. عبد اللطيف الوشلي صنع.
The United Arab Emirates has sparked anger among Palestinians by congratulating Israel on its so-called Independence Day, declared in 1948. The occasion is marked by Palestinians as the beginning of their displacement from their homeland. They view the day as the Nakba or Catastrophe Day.
What Israelis are marking is the day of our catastrophe, the day Palestinians were slaughtered by Zionist gangs. Hundreds of thousands of them were displaced from their homes and lands. The UAE should have sent a message to condemn the daily crimes and oppression committed by the Israeli soldiers and settlers against the Palestinians.
The UAE Embassy in Tel Aviv published a tweet wishing a happy Independence Day to the citizens of Israel, posting a photo of the Israeli and Emirati flags side by side. Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu replied by thanking the UAE.
The UAE has not only normalized ties with Israel, but also raised the ties to a new level. The UAE is also becoming Israel's partner in its aggression against the Palestinian people. The congratulation message comes as Israel is preventing Palestinians from entering the Al-Aqsa Mosque.
The UAE was among the first Arab countries to agree to normalize ties with Israel in 2020 under the so-called Abraham Accords, a pact brokered by former U.S. President Donald Trump. Bahrain, Morocco, and Sudan signed normalization deals with the Israeli regime shortly afterwards. Palestinians have angrily slammed normalization of ties between Israel and Arab states, including UAE. They say that since then, those states have been continuing to reward the regime and giving up the Holy Lands. Mona Kandil, Occupy Ramallah.
Iran's lead nuclear negotiator in Vienna, Deputy Foreign Minister Abbas Araghchi, says a new understanding is being reached amid attempts to revive the Iran nuclear deal, known as the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action, the JCPOA. Following a joint commission session with JCPOA signatories, Russia, China, Britain, France and Germany, Araghchi said negotiators can now start working on a common draft.
Drafting can begin at least in the areas where the sides share the same views. For that purpose, the Iranian delegation has prepared its drafts both on the nuclear measures and sanction lifting, and has presented its drafts to the other parties. And we believe these texts can form the basis for negotiations and a final agreement.
Although the nuclear measures that Iran needs to take to come back to full compliance are clear, there is less clarity when it comes to the list of U.S. sanctions that need to be removed.
China maintained that all U.S. sanctions should be lifted immediately. May it concern sanctions against Iran or its long-term jurisdiction measures affecting third country entities and individuals, including those on Chinese. So we are looking forward to such a drafting exercise.
Iran has remained steadfast in its position that it will only act after verifying the U.S.'s removal of all sanctions, including those imposed additionally or relabeled under former President Donald Trump. Although there have been no direct talks between Iran and the U.S., American delegates in Vienna have been engaged in talks with the EU coordinator and the other JCPOA signatories. Iran's lead delegate says there are still some serious differences that need to be worked out. For now, the expert working groups have been tasked with engaging in more substantive work for the next few days. Homa Lesky, Vienna.
If you're interested to know about history, culture, family, politics, religion, art, etc., you wouldn't want to miss the chance to tune into the IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/EM.
The Limelight.
The Derek Chauvin murder trial held closing arguments on Monday, 19th of April, before the jury began considering a verdict over the death of George Floyd that is anxiously awaited by millions of Americans. The article you're about to hear has been written by The Guardian columnist Chris McGreal. The piece is titled Derek Chauvin Jury Begins Deliberations as America Braces for Verdict. Stay with us for more of Chris McGreal's article. Derek Chauvin murder trial heard closing arguments on Monday, 19th of April, before the jury began considering a verdict over the death of George Floyd that is anxiously awaited by millions of Americans. Tensions are running high in Minneapolis, with hundreds of National Guard soldiers deployed. Last year, video of the former police officer's alleged killing of George Floyd, a 46-year-old black man, prompted days of protests, riots, and looting, and the demonstrations across the United States as well as the wider world. Protests flared up again earlier this month over the shooting of Daunte Wright, a 20-year-old black man, by police officers during a traffic stop in a Minneapolis suburb. Many Americans have reached their own verdict in the Derek Chauvin case and see the trial as part of a reckoning in the broader struggle for racial justice. Nonetheless, on Monday, 19th of April, 2021, lawyers focused on persuading the jury. Prosecutor Steve Schleicher said the key to the case lay in video footage of Derek Chauvin pressing his knee onto George Floyd's neck, even as he pleaded for his life, right to his very last words, "I can't breathe." "This case is exactly what you saw with your eyes. It's what you know in your heart," he said. Prosecutor Steve Schleicher said the video showed Derek Chauvin had a complete indifference to George Floyd. "For 9 minutes and 29 seconds, George Floyd begged until he could beg no more, and the defendant continued this assault," he said. The prosecutor said Chauvin's ego, his pride, led him to keep his knee in place, even as bystanders pleaded with him to stop because he wasn't going to be told what to do. "He was going to do what he wanted, how he wanted, for as long as he wanted," said Schleicher. "This was not policing. It was unnecessary. It was gratuitous, and he did it on purpose." If the jury agrees that Derek Chauvin, a 45-year-old, did commit an assault as he pinned George Floyd to the ground, that will open the path to a conviction on the most serious charge of second-degree murder, which requires the former police officer to have committed a felony that led to death. "What the defendant did here was straight-up felony assault," said Schleicher, "that killed George Floyd." If the jury does not agree with Chauvin's use of force was criminal in itself, but showed reckless disregard for human life, it could still convict him of third-degree murder. Derek Chauvin also faces a manslaughter charge. In instructions to the jury, Judge Peter Cahill said Derek Chauvin was culpable if he took an action that caused George Floyd's death, even if other factors contributed to it. "That will help the prosecution because even if, as the defense claims, heart damage and drug use contributed to Floyd's death, Chauvin will still be guilty if the jury finds his actions set heart failure in motion." Prosecutor Schleicher derided defense claims that Derek Chauvin's actions were not the cause of George Floyd's death and that he succumbed to a heart condition, drug use, and even carbon monoxide poisoning from car exhaust. Prosecutor Schleicher asked if George Floyd would have died that day if he hadn't been pinned down by Derek Chauvin and scorned the idea that he chose that moment to die of heart disease. "Use your common sense. Believe your eyes," he told the jurors. "Unreasonable force, pinning him to the ground, that's what killed him." Prosecutor Schleicher reminded the jury of testimony from medical experts who said the way Derek Chauvin and other police officers kept George Floyd pinned to the ground cut off his breathing and was the sole cause of his death. George Floyd struggled, desperate to breathe, to make enough room in his chest to breathe, but the force was too much, said Schleicher. Schleicher told the jurors they did not have to find that the defendant intended to cause harm or to violate the law in order to convict him of second-degree murder. "The only thing the state has to prove is that he intended to apply force to George Floyd on purpose," he said. Derek Chauvin's lawyer, Eric Nelson, focused on whether the police officer's actions were reasonable under the totality of circumstances, as George Floyd fought hard against getting into a squad car. "Someone can be compliant 1 second and then fight the next," he said. Defense lawyer Eric Nelson said it was reasonable for Derek Chauvin to believe George Floyd's pleas that he could not breathe were a ruse to avoid arrest. The lawyer dismissed the evidence of a medical expert that the moment Floyd's leg lashed out was evidence of a kind of brain damage due to lack of oxygen, as made with hindsight and a medical degree. A reasonable police will interpret this as at least some form of minimal resistance, he said. Eric Nelson portrayed Derek Chauvin as distracted by a crowd at the time of George Floyd took his last breath, saying he reached for his mace because he saw it as a threat. That changed Officer Chauvin's perception on what was happening, he said. Eric Nelson said the totality of the situation justified Derek Chauvin's actions and established his innocence. This was an authorized use of force, as unattractive as it may be, and this is reasonable doubt, he said. There is absolutely no evidence that Officer Chauvin intentionally or purposefully applied unlawful force. Nelson said it defied common sense for the prosecution to dismiss George Floyd's heart condition and drug use as causes of his death. But on rebuttal, the prosecution accused Eric Nelson of distorting the facts in claiming that the prosecution had to prove there were no other factors at play in George Floyd's death for Derek Chauvin to be found guilty. It said Nelson's claims defied common sense. The closing arguments unusually went on for much of the day on Monday, reflecting the complexities of the case and the widely differing interpretations of events. Jerry Blackwell, the Special Assistant Attorney General, who opened arguments for the prosecution 3 weeks ago, had the last word before the judge sent the jury out to deliberate. He told jurors that the case against Derek Chauvin was so simple that a child could understand it, which was why a 9-year-old bystander told the police officer to get off of George Floyd. Jerry Blackwell finished with an evocative line that went from the victim's medical condition to the police officer's character and emotion. He said to the jury, "You were told, for example, that Mr. Floyd died because his heart was too big, and now, having seen all of the evidence, having heard all of the evidence, you know the truth. And the truth of the matter is that the reason George Floyd is dead is because Derek Chauvin's heart was too small." Chauvin faces up to 40 years imprisonment. The 12 jurors will be sequestered until they reach a verdict or fail to agree on any of the charges. Deliberations will continue until 7 p.m. each day, but the judge said if a verdict is reached close to that time, it will not be revealed until the following day. The courthouse has been sealed off and is heavily guarded. Members of George Floyd's family said that after the trauma of the trial, they want it to be over. "We are ready to get this trial done," Tara Brown, George Floyd's cousin, told CNN. She added, "It was very difficult. There were times when we were literally broken to tears."
The debate.
Hello and a warm welcome to the debate. I'm your host, Behrouz Najafi. Welcome. Tensions have been simmering between the U.S. and Russia. U.S. Ambassador to Russia will return home for discussions with the Biden administration over the recent escalation. Now, last week, Washington imposed sanctions on Moscow over alleged meddling in the 2020 U.S. election and what Washington is calling severe human rights abuses in Crimea. In retaliation, the Kremlin sanctioned 8 senior U.S. officials. Washington is also at loggerheads with Beijing over such issues as the Chinese Taipei, Hong Kong, and South China Sea, among other things. Xi Jinping is speaking of a novel world governance system that's devoid of hegemony and unilateralism. So where's the world heading for? A new world order? What's that supposed to look like? Stay tuned for a debate on those topics.
Tensions between the United States and Russia appear to be ratcheting up in recent weeks over a range of issues, including Ukraine. The Russian Defense Ministry on Tuesday accused the U.S. and NATO of engaging in what it described as provocative activities in the waters and airspace of the Black Sea. Moscow also accused Kiev of trying to destabilize the situation in the eastern Donbass region. Amid escalating tensions, Washington and its NATO allies have rallied behind Kiev. They voiced concern over Russia's troop deployment along its borders with Ukraine, claiming Russia might be planning to invade the country. But Moscow said the military buildup was in response to cold, threatening military action by NATO and nothing more. Washington-Moscow tensions heightened after the U.S. administration announced a new array of anti-Russia sanctions last Thursday. The White House claimed the sanctions were in retaliation for a range of Russia's actions, including its alleged meddling in the U.S. election, cyber espionage, and action in Ukraine. The Kremlin responded with tit-for-tat measures. But the hostile attitude of the U.S. and its allies is not limited to Russia. They have also collectively formed and launched a pressure campaign against China. Just last month, the U.S., along with the European Union, Britain, and Canada, imposed coordinated actions on Beijing under the pretext of human rights violations. The United States and China have also been embroiled in disputes over a host of issues ranging from trade, Hong Kong, and Taiwan. Beijing has time and again accused Washington of seeking to destabilize mainland China by interfering in the affairs of Hong Kong and Chinese Taipei, as well as fomenting tensions in the South China Sea. The country last week escalated its military activities after the U.S. announced it would deploy its warships to the region. The Chinese president on Tuesday also criticized the hegemonic power structures in the global governance, calling for the rejection of such moves.
The future of the world should be mastered by all countries in the world. Rules made by a single country or just a few countries cannot be forcibly applied on others. The world order cannot be led by unilateralism from some country.
The growing tension between Washington on the one side and Moscow and Beijing on the other is bringing the two countries even closer. U.S. President Joe Biden will probably face a nightmare scenario given deepening ties and strategic cooperation between China and Russia, the countries Washington thinks is a threat to its global interests.
Now let me invite our guests to this debate tonight. We'll have journalist and political commentator Don DeBar from New York. Also, the senior analyst with Foreign Policy and Focus, Ian Williams, will also be joining us from New York. Thank you both gentlemen to the show. Starting with Don, Washington has been at odds with China over a plethora of issues, you know, including trade, Hong Kong, Taiwan, the South China Sea, and so on. And China has kept warning the U.S. against poking its nose into Beijing's domestic issues. How would you foresee things to develop?
Well, to develop from here, let's take a look at where we are. The history of United States relations with China, you know, you look back to the colonial period, the U.S. jockeying for its share of China's hide, and down through the revolution in 1949 and the task one being to undo that revolution, backing the fantasy I was at the Southern in Beijing.
Okay, now it looks like we have some problem, a technical problem. Let me go to the other guest, to Ian Williams, also in New York. Ian, the U.S. is also having issues with Russia over eastern Ukraine, alleged interference in the 2020 presidential election and hacking government agencies. The two have been trading barbs and also taking tit-for-tat measures against one another. Where is this going to end up, Ian?
Globally, it's a very difficult problem because it's a three-sided problem. Isaac Newton, when he calculated the laws of gravity and the movement of the planets, threw up his hands when it came to trying to plot three bodies together. the math is too complicated. And Russia and China don't have a bloc. Their common interest is making sure that the U.S. doesn't win over on either of them. The interests are completely separate. I mean, Russia is not an economic power. Russia is Saudi Arabia with nuclear weapons and inherited military technology from its greater days. It's not a serious threat to the US, but it's a serious threat in the vicinity. And we should remember, both of them are talking about hegemonic influencers and non-interference. The problem in Eastern Donbass is it's filled with Russian soldiers. That's the problem in Eastern Donbass. The problem in Crimea is that Russia occupied it. There may well be a case they could make, but they didn't make it in the international tribunals. They occupied territory illegally, which is the major no-no of the United Nations and the world order, a rules-based world order, which they're hypocritically talking about. Now, the US is hypocritical. The US has done all of these things as well. But you don't go preaching that back at people as though you're covered. China has broken an international agreement. It's arrested people, charged them with subversion for trying to uphold the international agreement that was made between China and Britain about the future of Hong Kong. Once again, that agreement was based upon one nation, two systems, which was supposed to be the model to seduce the Taiwanese into joining them. Now, the Chinese have messed that up completely. They've shown that they were only kidding. So the Taiwanese look and think, well, any agreement we make with Beijing is going to be thrown out the door right away. So, you know, there is room on both sides. Donald Trump wasn't at all interested in human rights. He left the Uyghurs to swing. He didn't care about Hong Kong. He was interested in the trade deal and the money. That's all he did. And we're getting serious here about the nature of the world and how it's changing. I mean, the Russians, they can threaten equivalent sanctions. What are they going to do? Refuse to let the Americans use the ruble for trade? They're not in a position to. China is different. And if China wants to carry on incrementally advancing the case for a non-dollar settlement of international affairs, it will be doing good for the whole world in removing U.S. hegemony over the world finance. But once again, it's a separate issue. A lot of what the U.S. is doing with China is about the trade. It's about also the fact that the U.S. just does not understand China. It's assuming that the only way that they can succeed is to have a neoliberal capitalist economy, and the Chinese have shown, as many other people in the past have shown, that in fact you can have a government-directed, government-shepherded economy and be extremely successful. The Chinese are an extreme case of what the Asians, Southeast Asian, the Asian Tigers have done over the years. The government has actively directed and interfered in the economy in the interests of stability and social equilibrium. Mm-hmm. The Americans just do not get that in their neoliberal phase at all. They can't understand that any industry in China is going to be directed by the state.
Okay.
Indirectly, or you know, it's to some measure. And they will have social aims, which include full employment in creating the economy. Whereas the U.S., the corporations can look after themselves. Mm-hmm. People, ordinary people, can look after themselves.
Okay.
They're completely different systems, and the U.S. Leadership don't understand that.
Okay, Ian, speaking about China, now in the midst of all these differences between the two, the Chinese president is calling for an end to unilateralism and global hegemony. So it seems that China has already taken steps in that direction too, don't you agree? I mean, warming ties with Russia, the Belt and Road Initiative, etc.
Well, it's up to a point, but the Belt and Road Initiative is a massive one, but that's getting kicked back as well. There's a lot of people on the way are thinking, maybe this isn't such a free bargain as it looked, you know, as the Chinese companies take over ports and they realize, in a sense, they substituted Western imperialism for Han imperialism from China, it seems to a lot of them. Sometimes the Chinese agreements are just overwhelmingly generous, but there's often a sting in the tail. There's bait and there's a hook in there as well. Mm-hmm. So the Chinese end up with a massive amount of infrastructure and they're building a new world order. And by the way, this is legitimate. It's what the Americans and the British did beforehand. They built in the same way, but the Chinese weren't strong enough to complain at the time. Now they are doing what the British and the others did and the Chinese did before that, the Americans did before them. And this is one of the problems. If you look at the last two world wars, there were out powers declining in competition with incoming rising powers, whether it was Imperial Germany, Nazi Germany, Imperial Japan. There were countries that felt that they'd been locked out because the spoils had been taken by their predecessors. That's what those wars were really about. And now that's the position the Chinese and to some extent the Russians getting some degree of resurgence from the real depths that they sunk into after Yeltsin had dismembered their economies and dismembered their power. They want their place back in the sun, and other people have taken them since then, and they're all looking. Ukraine doesn't want to be part of the Soviet Union. I wish they did. I mean, I'm in favor of international unions, but it's quite clear that Ukraine does not want to, and the Russians have not really gone on a hearts and minds things about it, sending divisions and tanks to occupy it and shooting down airliners and poisoning dissidents is not the way to win hearts and minds globally. So neither of these countries is really doing their best on this.
Okay. Now let's go back to Dan DeBar. Dan, looks like we've managed to fix that technical hitch, hopefully. So sorry for that interruption. Go ahead with your comments.
Yeah, well, it's not exactly fixed. We're going to use the telephone. First of all, I mean, what I'm hearing essentially are talk points coming from the other guest. There's Russia is not an antagonist here. The United States engineered a coup d'etat on Russia's border. Half the population of that country on Russia's border are Russians. One of Russia's primary military bases in water or in that territory. These are all well known to the United States and their objectives of U.S. foreign policy. John Sullivan, U.S., who came from Rumsfeld and Trump and all of them, also was very busy in the Obama administration. He's a part of the consensus in Washington that has since 1917 decided that the oil and gas and natural resources of Russia belong to U.S. oil companies. And he's been one of the lawyers and lobbyists and other people that sought to do that for their clients for many years and then came into the government, obviously, to facilitate that policy further. What he represents now, with Trump's face having been imposed on his earlier actions and his being able to be an honest broker with the last, on part of the last regime, is a more realistic approach to trying to exploit Russia, which is without starting a nuclear war first. Whereas the Biden administration, like the Obama administration, like the earlier administrations, including Clinton, seem to think that the way to get what they want out of Russia is to threaten it with war. And we find ourselves in a situation like we were when Trump took office from Obama, with U.S. troops up against Russia's borders again, their attempt by U.S. CIA and others to create chaos inside Russia and its allies, like you see happening again in Belarus, to try to pressure those regimes to make concessions to hand over the country's wealth to the West. That's essentially what we see going on. Putin's mood and poisoning this one because Time magazine said so, et cetera, is all sideshow.
All right. John, what about, you know, the fact that China and Russia also getting closer to each other and they have a joint rival or adversary, if you will, whatever. Now, some observers argue that the growing ties between China and Russia could prove to be a nightmare scenario that could challenge Joe Biden's leadership to a great degree. Do you share that view? Don, are you with us?
Oh, okay. Yeah. let's see. First, as far as Biden's leadership, Biden is occupying a chair. There are people that bring him things to sign and put words in front of him to mouth in front of TV cameras and such. He is not making policy. The policy made him. And so let's keep things, you know, oriented. Right, put them on their head and not. The United States created a condition where Russia and China have essentially no choice but to be strategic partners. Regardless of what the individual ambitions might be of people in the elites of either country, to be the other, and Asia, which is rising as the global center, generally, regardless of that, they realize that the United States, having its military resources bumping up against Russian air defenses in Eastern Europe and China's air defenses in the South China Sea, and playing footsie with the naval exercises and everything else, installing THAADs in Korea, et cetera, they understand that no matter which one the U.S. comes for first, they're coming for the other one next. And so they realize they have to be strategic partners, and that lesson was taught to them by the United States, particularly the Obama administration, which pivoted to Asia and started aggressively against both of them. They were challenging China on the seas of the South China Sea at the same time that they pushed the revolution in Ukraine, and they had a whole bunch of other installs of anti-missile missiles in Romania and other places. Both of those countries could see what's coming, and so they are now strategic allies by necessity.
Okay. Ian Williams, we have only 1 minute. If you could tell me briefly, in which direction is the world moving? Are we supposed to have a new world order?
It's moving towards more instability. I'd like to make a point that the newly assertive China is claiming huge tracts of the South China Sea that every other country in the area disputes, and that China refuses to put that to an international tribunal. It's behaving in the same hegemonic way it accuses the United States of. It's threatening to invade Taiwan. It has refused to say, we are not going to take military action. If the Taiwanese want us, we'll come. If they don't, we won't. And I should say, by the way, that goes against history, because Chairman Mao told Edgar Snow in the Red Star over China that the first thing after the Second World War was that Formosa, Taiwan, would have an act of self-determination, because he was a bit more principled than the current leaders. But we go on. In Russia, Russia is occupying Crimea. It occupied Crimea in defiance of the United Nations and the international community that has about the admissibility of acquiring military of territory by military force. It's gone and poisoned people in other countries. So much for respecting hegemony. It's poisoned a known dissident. And it's not a myth. You've actually got recordings of the people who did it confessing to it. I mean, Putin is wandering around there, and some people, like our colleague, seem to think that he's a progressive revolutionary.
Yeah,
when
I
in
have
fact,
to jump in. I'm sorry.
He's a hegemonic bully.
All the time that we have. I'm sorry for interrupting you. Let me thank our guests. So we had journalist and political commentator Don DeBar out of New York, and also senior analyst with Foreign Policy and Focus, Ian Williams.